Hello, everyone. Welcome to the second episode in this Group 1 AI and the South African Law podcast series. I'm Gavin Rome, a senior counsel at Group 1 Advocates in Sandton, South Africa. And I'm very pleased and excited to be hosting this series. I will be joined from time to time by my colleagues in Group 1, Sushaba Mahapi and Ziad Minty, who are both junior counsel practicing from our group. In this series, we are exploring the multifaceted and potentially revolutionary impact which the new artificial intelligence tools will have on all aspects of the South African legal system. We aim to delve into topics ranging from AI's challenges to existing intellectual property frameworks, to need for responsible regulation to address the dangers posed by the increased pervasiveness of AI in our everyday lives, to AI's potential to promote timely and affordable judicial outcomes and access to the law. Throughout the series, we will be interviewing experts on these and other crucial issues. The topic of today's podcast is something much closer to our hearts: AI and its impact on the South African legal profession. As with the other professions, AI is already starting to change the nature of our legal practices. These changes will only be intensified in the future. The advent of AI technologies has, in my view, been aptly described as commencing the fourth industrial revolution. The increased use of AI comes with the promise of many and great socio-economic benefits. There are also many resonant and ringing warnings about the dystopian-type risks posed by the advancing penetration of AI technology in all aspects of our lives. As with society at large, the advent of legal AI tools promises many benefits. The future widespread and pervasive use of AI legal technology also comes with seriously detrimental risks. Today, to further explore the dynamic role and future of AI within and on the South African legal profession, we are fortunate to have two outstanding professional experts joining us. After a bit of internet sleuthing, quickly discovered that each of our guests has an almost intimidatingly impressive CV. So briefly, let me welcome each of the guests as best as I can in a few short sentences. I'm delighted to introduce Leanne Mostert and Ali Amani, who are both experienced intellectual property lawyers practicing in Cape Town. Leanne is a partner at Webber Wenzel, one of South Africa's largest law firms. Leanne has some 28 years of experience as an IP lawyer and years of experience specifically heading her firm's technology, media, and telecommunications sector. Leanne's extensive experience leading a team of IP lawyers and her team's adoption of AI technology tools make her insights invaluable. Alia is head of legal services and technology, also at Webber Wenzel. She leads that firm's Fusion Legal Technology Initiative. She brings substantial experience in legal AI, including time as a COO of a North American IT corporate. We are very lucky that her firm was able to lure her back to South African shores. Leanne and Alia are uniquely positioned to discuss real-world challenges brought about by AI in legal practices, the challenges they've encountered, and how they are leveraging these technologies. So let's dive right in. Alia, thinking back to when this latest wave of AI and legal tech really hit the mainstream, what was your very first reaction when you started encountering these new tools at work?
I guess it depends on your definition, because AI in some manner, shape or form has always been used in the way we practice. But I think generative AI side, or where AI has been used for large volumes of data, so it was probably maybe 2017 or so, where it was being used for due diligence use cases and then increasingly so for e-discovery. I think after the generative AI wave began, we started to see more examples of things like chatbots, summarization, those sort of simple efficiency gains. And now we're moving into a world where it's doing a lot more than that. Reasoning, something that feels like intelligence in a different way.
So when you began to encounter this new level of legal tech, AI, large language models, chatbots, GPT, what was your first reaction to this new wave of technology, particularly the AI layer on legal tech?
Yeah, actually, it's funny you say that, because I was actually just had my second child and I was in the hospital and someone came to visit me and they said, "Have you seen ChatGPT?" so what is this thing? And I kind of ignored it until later that night, and I was on maternity leave at Weber's, having just rejoined into this role. And I remember thinking, oh goodness, we should be worried, and immediately sent a series of emails thinking about everything from, you know, our AI policies to what it means for training in humans. So I was initially panicked and then calmed down when I took a deeper look at it, try to see that at the time, and this was sort of early 2023, it seemed to be missing quite a lot. It was repetitive. It sounded quite smart and very intelligent and seemed to mimic the way we engage, but it wasn't as smart as it is now. But even back then, there was a sense that we had to take it seriously because of the way the information would be received, as well as the fact that AI was suddenly accessible in a different way. And because it was the way in which you engage with the AI was through words, and we are in the business of words and language when we practice law. So even back then, we knew we had to take it seriously. The scale of development has been quite something to watch, especially in recent months. But I actually remember the moment I was in the hospital bed on my phone and thinking, okay, this is something we should be thinking about.
Your dedication to technology and your firm seems to be at a level beyond mere mortals, but you certainly can date your first use of ChatGPT back to a significant moment in your life. My first moment of using it was when my beloved dog Jeremy had just passed away suddenly, and we asked ChatGPT to generate a sonnet in Elizabethan verse with a few prompts about quirky Jeremy and his abrupt death. And whilst the bard wouldn't have loved it, it's certainly nobody could have produced it quicker. And I thought this was a transformative technology. Leanne, do you have a similar moment when you first encountered a moment of being startled or surprised or dismayed, but a significant moment when you first encountered AI as a tool above ordinary legal tech?
Yes, it certainly was a big shock. And for me, it worried me on a number of levels. I think for me personally, being an older attorney, I was less concerned about my future in law and what it would do to my future. But I have two young daughters who are also thinking of practicing law. And so I started to think, wow, how are we going to train young lawyers? Because obviously it's really, really important if you're going to be drafting well to develop those drafting skills. We think that's important. But how will we train our young lawyers when we can use these tools so effectively? And, you know, do we need as many candidate attorneys? Do we need as many associates, etc.? So it was very worrying for me.
Can I pick up on that? There's two streams in the legal profession. One side is that AI is more trouble than it's worth, and another, which is more evangelical about the transformative effect of AI. But from what you've just said, particularly about replacing candidate attorneys or associates, is there an element of AI can do our jobs better than we can do it?
I think I'm hopeful that we can still do it better than AI, but most importantly, we'll do it better with AI. It is an extraordinary tool, and in my experimentation with the different capabilities of these tools, I am blown away by what we can do and how much quicker we can do it. The final result, I think, will also be better than what we would do in our normal time. But ultimately, I think it is just an extraordinary tool for us to work with. And so I don't think it'll replace lawyers, but I worry about how we train people when they can so effectively use these tools to generate first drafts or starting points on various documents, and therefore we would need less lawyers to do it because you're not going to need the same number of hours. I mean, that's, of course, I'm predicting things. We'll see how it actually plays out. But those are things that started to worry me about our future practice of law, but also tremendous excitement at the possibilities. And also, I think many of us really enjoy the more complex, negotiations that we attend to and advising our clients. And so in this way, we can spend more time doing the really exciting, complex stuff and less time on the aspects that we could instruct AI to do.
Two things which come from that, and if I could ask both of you, there's on one side, there's a question about whether it can do it more efficiently. On the other side, there is a question about there's some parts of the interaction with clients which no machine can, however capable, can replace. But have you, either of you, had the experience where you can recall that AI significantly, as an augmentative tool, enhanced the ultimate product that you were able to deliver to your client?
I guess there are two streams that are interesting. The first is something that people might expect, which is in very high volume scenarios, millions of communications, thousands and thousands of documents, a deadline that's, around the corner. And even if you had enough humans to do the work and not sleep during that period, you probably wouldn't meet the deadline, and/or it would be very costly. So in those scenarios, AI does well because, especially if you put good processes in place around quality assurance and vetting, and ensuring the output is of the right quality, accuracy, relevance, etc., then you can have a stronger outcome because you can achieve better results in a shorter period of time at a more appropriate cost. There are other instances where it does well, which is, I guess, a translation, not necessarily into another language, although it can do that as well, but taking words and translating them into data points and visualizations that can help clients sort of understand populations of data or lots of documents and sort of the material issues differently, which allows for better decision making. The interesting thing about AI are the insights that you can glean that are different to what a human could necessarily produce, especially in the same period of time. And so it's everything from, a long memorandum and translating it into bullet points, which is the obvious one. Everyone talks about summarization. But what about translating those words into a series of pie charts and graphs and a way of filtering information and translating it into a project plan? AI is pretty good at doing all of those things, especially in a world where, as lawyers, we've been trained to use words and use Microsoft Word specifically, and not always Excel and not always design skills. And so AI can help with some of those kinds of outputs and requirements. And it allows us to align better with our clients who often need to do those things, translate legal things into other formats and to other sort of actionable insights for their internal stakeholders.
Leanne, in your experiences, in your practice, has that been one where AI is better at not only saving time, but it has an augmentative or an improving effect on what you can ultimately achieve on a particular negotiation?
Yes, I think certainly it saves time, as you say, and I mean for summarizing things like Alia's referred to, but also in due diligences, it can be extremely helpful to scan in a bunch of documents and get certain data points that you're looking for, and you can obviously do that really quickly. You've of course got to check the work, but it's a lot quicker to check it once it's been done. I think what I've really enjoyed is, of course, with intellectual property, we're looking so often at what's happening in other jurisdictions because that is impacting on our clients' intellectual property to see how it can, you know, best be protected and what is happening in the different jurisdictions. And doing that type of research is phenomenal on AI, asking it for, you know, recent judgments in different jurisdictions and asking it for, you know, like the US Copyright Office, what they've been saying recently. I follow it all the time, what is happening in the US, the Patent Office, the Copyright Office, to best understand how particular, you know, developments are occurring, but particularly developments relating to AI and the what can be protected from AI-generated works and inventions. It's advancing and changing globally frequently. And that type of research can be done very, very quickly with AI. And of course, clicking on the footnotes takes you to the source documents, which you need to check. But it's a lot quicker than us trying to do that ourselves.
We'll get back to the particular technology which you're using at Weber Wenzel, because I'd like to find out if that's just the general ChatGPT or something bespoke. Picking up on your point about legal research, we live in the world of explosive growth in data. In whatever field we're in, and particularly in law, judgments are proliferating, and the expectation that you are familiar with and have some ability to traverse a wide set of legal data is acutely felt across all sectors of the legal profession, whether from judges to attorneys to advocates. But focusing on a moment, what are your clients' expectations? If you do not use AI, are your clients apprehensive that they are being left behind and your firm is not delivering the services which they expect? And conversely, what are the concerns of your clients which you've encountered about the use of AI, whether it's the safeguarding the sources of the material work which you're doing for your client, or whether it is your AI having an hallucinatory moment?
Sure. So there are a few pillars to that, Gavin. The first is that we have had a fair amount of client engagement. Some clients who prefer us not to use AI and have since changed their minds once they understood the gains to be had. And there are other clients who expect it and would mark us down in RFQs and RFPs and ability to win particular mandates if we didn't have those tools. And it's not sort of an innovation theater point, I guess, but really because it impacts their experience on the matter and our ability to deliver on that matter within their requirements. So there is a client expectation to use AI, but importantly to use it responsibly and safely. And there are a spectrum of questions we respond to. The first, of course, as you can imagine, is on the IT and infrastructure and data security side, which is which systems are you using? How does it impact our data, our client data? And there, they're not only worried about their personal information, the names of their directors, as an example, or the shareholders, but actually deal structures or privileged information about something currently under dispute. And the issue there is the underlying technology or the vendors themselves who make that technology available, or if you're using an LLM, is there training happening on that data? Where is that data being processed? Is it encrypted? And that is because they have certain requirements they need to meet, their end clients. They have internal policies to ensure that data is being processed, retained, hosted appropriately, and they're trying to protect their intellectual property and their sensitive information, as well as their ability to retain things like ISO 27001 compliance, which we have as well. Beyond just the cybersecurity risks, malicious actors trying to access their information, it's a real requirement of their end clients and as well as their internal policies. We need to align with that as well. And how that translates is everything to how, what technology we use, the infrastructure and the foundations we build around that, the kinds of people we hire, the processes we implement, every step along the way to ensure that data is protected and we're able to audit and confirm what exactly has happened. To the vendors we partner with, the vendors we buy from, and the skills we have to bring into our teams, which are increasingly multidisciplinary. I'm not sure if I've answered.
Yes, no, I think you have. It's a big question, which deserves a big answer. Just to go back, for those who will be listening to this podcast who aren't immediately familiar with the acronyms, you mentioned that it affects your RFQs and your RFPs in your dealings with clients and your ability to attract and retain clients. What yes. are those acronyms about?
Request for proposals, request for quotations. So can you do this work, Weber Wenzel? Can you meet our scope of work? And at what price? How you deliver the work? What technology will you use? Which experts will you bring onto the matter? And at what price? So essentially, that's what we have to answer for. And increasingly, one of the questions they ask relate to AI, but also generally, you know, AI is part of our toolkit, which is part of a people, process, data, technology question.
Leanne, one of the things which does strike me is that there are a host of academics who are saying that AI is going to be producing something called outputs, and once there's a focus on outputs rather than the relationship between a particularly skilled attorney or team of attorneys and clients, and clients are become more interested in the outputs, is that our traditional billing models of 6 minutes and billable hours are going to be replaced with something which is far more cost effective, and clients will expect a new billing model. Do you have any thoughts in that regard?
We have not yet had pressure from our clients in our normal legal work. Alia would have, you know, would have delivered more cost-effective legal services for some of the projects she has referred to, but we haven't had a pressure on our current pricing. But I've never liked our pricing model. I think it's very unfortunate. It's far more about what we produce and what we deliver than the time it takes to do so. So I will welcome other pricing models, but it is going to be difficult to figure out how we price this. And, you know, for now, I think we need to look at AI as a very valuable tool that augments what we do and can help us do it quicker, but hopefully also better. But of course, at the moment, we still need to really check the work. So I still treat an output from AI as something a candidate attorney has delivered, and you check it thoroughly because it could have a number of hallucinations in it, etc. Of course, we do expect that as we train these models more on our systems, they are going to become more reliable and dependable. It's going to be very interesting how we have to look at pricing going forward, but I haven't had pricing pressure from my clients yet.
It's funny how technologies can make things go full circle. In many decades ago at the bar, counsel would mark their fees as on trial and refresher for trial. And that would be obviously linked to value, not time. So AI may take us back to a pre-billable hours. Just picking up the term or AI models learning more seems to be a good segue into what is known as a captive legal services provider in other jurisdictions, and what I think is referred to at your firm as Weber-Wenzel Fusion. And if I could ask Alia just to explain how she came to be involved in Weber-Wenzel Fusion. I do understand that you were attracted back to this jurisdiction from leading a tech initiative called SNAPT, which we mentioned earlier. So perhaps you can just tell us a little bit in that answer about your journey to Weber-Wenzel Fusion and what the Fusion legal services provider is all about.
Sure, happy to. So my background was, I actually started as a candidate attorney at Weber-Wenzel, qualified. Leanne was, in fact, the head of our practice group at the time, and eventually made it to partner. And through my journey, engaged with a lot of tech companies who were clients, and eventually just to scratch that itch, I suppose, or to kind of flex different muscles, wanted to join a company and do things outside of law. So I was a COO there, and was involved, you know, cross-functionally across the business in everything from hiring to product roadmap to fundraising. But Weber-Wenzel has always been an innovative law firm. And before I rejoined, they started something called the Legal Services Center, which some of you may know as business process outsourcing, but for legal. And that's how it started, lower cost legal project management based, but always tech enabled. And throughout the world, there have been institutions and organizations that offer these, sometimes within law firms and sometimes outside of law firms as law companies. I think of the big law firms in Africa, we were the first to do that. Fusion is, I guess, a reimagination of that for where technology is today, but also to align with client expectations and to add, I suppose, an entrepreneurial flair to it. We have client-facing solutions that didn't exist 6 months to a year ago. Within Fusion, there are mostly lawyers, but there are also technologists, including engineers. You have project managers. You have people with business experience. So if you imagine the layers outside of law or fit with law, ancillary to law, we try and provide those kinds of client solutions, especially with a data piece to it. And then the other part of what Fusion does is we also support, enable, and sometimes lead technology initiatives that take the business, advance the business. So whether that's on the AI and legal technology front, as to what the firm should be using in delivering its services or what it should be selling to its clients from a technology perspective, that has been our focus area, and our mandate continues to expand, you know, more broadly on the innovation side.
You know, it seems like there's a Moore's law which is at place here, which is that changes in the profession are going to double. What's it, every 12 months or every 24 months? And there's always resistance to technology. And there's stories that the English bar was outraged when they were introduced to the fax and they're told that this would become the method of sending communications in written form. All those years ago, in which people of my vintage recall fax technology as being something innovative. Can you tell us about resistance that you've encountered from colleagues, counsel, other stakeholders in the legal profession?
Yeah, I suppose there's quite a lot of fear, especially before you investigate it. And what we found quite interesting is that some of the junior lawyers have been the most resistant. One would have thought our more senior partners would have been. But I think that they are afraid of the impact that AI could have on their future. And, you know, it doesn't make any sense to avoid it. Obviously, they should be diving in and learning about this tool and figuring out how it can make them better and how it can improve their futures in the practice of law. But I think due to fear, they are delaying exploring AI. But yeah, but I think most people are, it's certainly in our firm, most people are excited about the opportunity, keen to find out how we can use it, but of course always a bit worried as well about what impact it can have on the practice of law.
Alia, do you have any anecdotes or encounters where you've seen resistance to the use of AI in the legal setting?
I'm happy to say that for the most part in our firm, I haven't seen too much of that. And you can imagine by the time I'd re or sort of landed back at Weber Wentz, and a lot of this goes down to mindset and culture and the message from the top, and what people are trained on from day one. But I think there are a couple of things and the reasons that people are skeptical. The first is, of course, there have been all those headlines about hallucinations. That's fair enough. AI is not foolproof. AI is not a silver bullet. It does make mistakes. It hallucinates. It sometimes applies things incorrectly. And of course, it's improving. But for as long as something is imperfect, people are going to be skeptical. And there's going to be a question about whether it is going to be a time saving if in fact you need to validate. Our response to that historically has been to say, you are using AI not simply because you are trying to save time. In fact, sometimes you are actually going to spend more time because perhaps the technology is proposing a checklist that you need to comply with to ensure a product of a higher quality. Perhaps it's taking you through a document proofing exercise to make sure that it's correctly polished. Potentially, the time you're saving removing some of the rote admin menial type work is going to surface more time for you to understand the nuances of the matter, more to do like a bunch more research. The funny thing is that the best lawyers are often the busiest lawyers. And so if you give the best lawyers more time, they're just going to give you a better and better product. And so
That's a
they're just going to
wonderful
raise
insight.
into, you know, what they can do. So Leanne is just going to think about it more deeply instead of, you know, checking every full stop and comma, which now technology can do, instead of worrying about whether her associate has processed everything that has come up in the call of yesterday. She's going to be thinking about that edge case around the corner about the law that may change because it's cross-border and related to the EU. She's going to spend more time thinking around the edges and around the corners, and she's going to give you proactive advice. When that lands for people, it just kind of booms. But you need to push them along to try to be open that it's not going to always give it to you in the format you want it. You're going to have to ask it to do things differently. You're going to have to get creative around how you use it and when you apply it and to the right use cases and with the right people. I always still believe in that tipping point where a sufficient number of people are using something or doing things differently, eventually everyone does.
And certainly in the field of litigation, we've had two tipping points. We've had case lines replacing those horrible old brown court files, which were invariably lost whenever they were needed. And also, because of the technology acceleration from COVID, the use of online courts has proliferated very quickly in South Africa. It brings us back, me back to this question, a broader question. Is there a way that AI can be used, which would assist people to access justice? And I don't just mean courtrooms. I mean, I'm talking about high-quality legal products, which the majority of people simply cannot afford. Is there a way that AI will have a democratizing effect on the ability of members of the public to procure legal answers and legal outputs?
I would answer that it already has and it's going to accelerate. I don't know if you saw the headline. The regulators in the UK actually approved a company called Garfield AI, which is going to be sending £2 letters of demand. And I mean, at that price point, you can demand.
Is the demand for payment of £2, which would be about 48 rand, or does it cost £2 to send a demand letter?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that's apparently the price point. Maybe I misread the article.
Yeah, I've got it, yes.
Some of the experts talk about legal information versus legal advice. Some of what we as individuals need in our personal capacity or in our business, small businesses, is actually information about how to do something. And the answer isn't difficult. It's just not always accessible or easy to understand. And so AI can do those things better and faster. And depending on the type of law firm you are, that's not necessarily what you're in the business of doing. I mean, I would worry if I was a law firm who was just dispensing information. The law says this and you can do A, B, and C. If you're doing something more advisory where you're applying the law to a nuanced set of facts or where the law is gray, you're in a fundamentally different position. But so much of the work, the legal work to be done, or the legal questions people have actually don't even land up at law firms because lawyers are just too expensive. And so if you start to make that information available in a more meaningful way beyond just Google searches, then of course you can enable access to justice. And you may have also seen headlines where people have tried to use bots in courts in the US, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
We've had that experience in South Africa with Heads of Argument, the notorious case in Pietermaritzburg in the KwaZulu-Natal High Court. But also there's a judgment which somebody simply using Google was able to prepare Heads of Argument, a layperson. And the court in this judgment in the Western Cape says, I have to compliment these Heads of Argument. When I asked Mr. X how he did so, he said he simply did it by using Google, and concludes with, one day soon, the computers are coming for our jobs. And I think the point you're making is they're coming for jobs in the sense that mundane tasks can be done. Can I just switch streams for a moment just to come back to something? Leanne, is your firm using a particular product or is it just general use of ChatGPT in its latest iteration, and whether those should or are being implemented by something which is particular to the legal users, such as your large law firm?
Sure. So Gavin, I'll share some information where we're not under NDA or exclusivity and not revealing our IP too much. But there are things. So we don't simply say use ChatGPT. It's a general model. It's been trained on vast corpus of the internet, lots of data, hugely valuable, but only for certain purposes. It doesn't comply with the security requirements and other requirements of our firm, especially in terms of how it interacts with and processes data. More than that, functionally, there are many things it can't do and hasn't been kind of trained or tailored for legal workflows. There are other publicly available models that anyone can access, either paid and for free, that are enormously useful and which we encourage people to use for personal purposes, for general purposes, the way they would use Google. But especially when you're dealing with sensitive information, client information, we have a series, not just one tool, and we continue to expand that toolkit. It includes some narrow tools which we have built for specific workflows, for example, in the tax team. In other cases, we've done things so people can more meaningfully access and sweat our intellectual property, being a firm of 150 years old. In other cases, it's actually using old AI automation. We leverage all the top e-discovery tools. And then we have a series of generative AI tools that we continue to expand on and build specific workflows around. And I would encourage people to, if they were thinking about their legal technology strategy, to align what your firm does and your sweet spot to the model that can best serve that outcome. And we certainly don't believe in, you know, a once and done, buy one tool off the shelf with a particular third party and you'll be fine. Of course, you should if you, you know, are looking to dip your toes in the water, but it's certainly not just a sort of a set and forget kind of decision.
That brings into question or into focus the ethical use of AI by lawyers, particularly in preserving client confidentiality. Attorneys' firms are regularly outsourcing aspects of their work, whether it is to an expert, a forensic expert in an accounting matter, or to a litigation expert in a counsel matter. What expectations, Leanne, do you have on two aspects? One, the use of AI by external providers, such as counsel, such as expert witnesses, and as to their using AI, and what expectations do you have about their responsible use of AI and making sure that your concerns about confidentiality are taken into account by counsel when they receive a brief?
Yeah, it's incredibly important, particularly, I mean, I of course think particularly for intellectual property, because they're not, you know, a lot of the confidentiality is very key to the nature of the IP asset, because obviously lots of people have, for example, trade secrets, and keeping them secret is critical to protecting them going forward. So for us, it's really crucial that anyone who is using AI is using it highly responsibly and would only be either inputting information that isn't confidential to the client if they're doing research, or doing it in circumstances where their enterprise model is protecting the client information. It's not being shared or becoming part of the public domain in any way. So it's crucial to us that, and that's the way we manage our use of AI internally as well. All the training of everyone using AI, it's a crucial element that they understand client confidentiality and how important it is not to use publicly available models for any sensitive information.
This does point to some need for both internal professional regulation and regulation in general, both to protect data and also to use AI in an ethical manner. We are a small economy on the foot of Africa, but what role do you think our institutions can play in devising regulations and creating a regulatory environment where we can best use the benefits of AI but have handrails and guards in place to prevent its abuse? Perhaps we can start with you, Alia.
And if legislation is very important, and we could see good legislation down the line. However, I'm not holding my breath, considering how long we've seen most of these legislative processes taking. We look north and to the east, to Australia, and to other countries to see how they are dealing with this. And we encourage our clients to act in accordance with that when we are devising, for example, AI policies for them. But I'm not expecting legislation to come out anytime soon in South Africa.
Alia, what Leanne is pointing to is a need for, until the legislation catches up with the pace of change, the need to internally regulate our use of AI in accordance with best practices which are emerging across the legal profession generally, universally.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that approach?
Yes, I would agree with that approach. And just to the start of your question, I think the short answer is we should and we must, because we are stakeholders. It impacts our business, but we you know, have the benefit of advising across different industries on how the law should impact those businesses. And there have been vast debates about whether our country's AI policy goes far enough. And that needs to be counterbalanced against the reality that sometimes regulation holds us back from commercialization, from, you know, businesses who maybe seek jurisdictions which are either less restrictive or create more opportunities. So there's a lot to balance as South Africans thinking about regulation.
I was at a book festival recently where the doyen of Arthur Goldstuck was presenting his book on AI, a simplified guide or something along those lines. And he said, well, given the United States' current lack of any interest of regulation of any industry, the world is going to not have the necessary regulatory environment. So it's hard to create an environment in one jurisdiction where there's permissiveness, if that's the correct word, or a more libertarian approach in another jurisdiction, is the point I think you were making.
Yeah.
Or may have been making.
And we particularly struggle in South Africa. So I think we do need to have a commitment to move faster and to listen more. And that requires kind of industry and government coming together more in a more concerted way, perhaps.
Perhaps one of the things which South Africa can bring to bear is our experience in avoiding the skewed patterns of learn large language models, which may be skewed to a particular demographic, and we could bring our experience in that to make sure that there is a consistency of the data which is being approached, not from the perspective of only a privileged group, but from a more broader perspective. Just to go back to AI, there is, at least in the advocates' profession, a perception that AI has Orwellian and dystopian implications. And it's going to be a question which we'll be ending off each of these podcast series with, for on a scale of 0 to 10, 0 being a dystopian nightmare and A being a nirvana in which AI enables us to have more leisure time, democratizes our work, makes it more effective, makes it more accessible, and heralds a bright or a brave new world. That's number 10. Where would you be?
I'm always an optimist, so I'll go with 8.
Alia, and yourself, do you likewise have that optimistic score?
I think I'd be somewhere between a 6 and an 8,
yeah,
but leaning towards a 7.5. Primarily because, yeah, I think there are a lot of people and process considerations that we need to think about and we need to be mindful of.
Yes. Well, you're not that far apart, a 7.5 and an 8, which is certainly places you who are both involved, takes a part of your working life, assume every day or almost every day the use of AI. And it's encouraging, at least from my perspective, that you have both largely a more optimistic than a negative outlook. Well, on that note, thanks, Alia. Again, thank you, Leanne. Thank you for your time. It's been a privilege and a pleasure speaking to you both.